Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 32 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we currently our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off this three-episode stint is Father David. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back. I am really excited for this episode. This episode is something that had a big impact on me back when I was in seminary, getting ready to be a priest. There's a very powerful scene in this set of minutes that I cannot wait to talk about.
Yes, I know that, and that's why you were invited to be on this part, because I knew you wanted to talk about this. So I'm very happy to have you here to enlighten all of us about it. So. Episode 32 begins with Lip coming out of the fog and ends with Winters getting a report from Doc Rowe.
Boy, I am glad Lip is okay, because I did not think Lip was going to make it. He got blown back so far. I was so relieved. Like, oh, he's going to be fine.
Yes. But, well, you know, they can't kill Donnie Wahlberg. Come on. That's, He had a rocket-propelled grenade explode in front of him, and he got thrown back. And this segment begins with him basically waking up from being apparently knocked out for a few seconds with a lot of debris and fog all around him. And he, you know, we see that there's a little blood coming out of his nose and a little out of his ear. And one of the guys runs over to him and goes, "Hey, buddy." He goes, "You're okay, Lip." And he goes, and then Lip looks down and he sees that his whole crotch area is filled with blood. And you know, the guy
that eye line to me is so funny. It's so funny how the camera lingers on him looking right down at his pants, because he has only one concern on his mind.
Okay, I mean, you can sort of understand that.
I understand it. It's still pretty funny.
Yes. Oh, it's hilarious. But again, they're showing that this guy's injured, and that's what they need to make sure that everything is where it should be. the guy helping him out just rips open his his crotch and turns to him and goes, "You're okay, Lip. Everything's right where it should be."
That's a real bro moment. That's a real man-to-man moment there.
Completely. There's no question about that. So I actually wanted to read the paragraph in the book that talks about this. So it says it's on page 73 of the Band of Brothers book, and it says, "Mortars continued coming in, along with sniper fire. Lipton led 3rd Platoon to the intersection and peeled off to the right. There were explosions on the street. He huddled against the wall and yelled to his men to follow him. A mortar shell dropped about 2 meters in front of him, putting shell fragments in his left cheek, right wrist, and right leg, and his right leg at his crotch. His rifle clattered to the street. He dropped to the ground, put his left hand to his cheek, and felt a large hole. But his biggest concern was his right hand, as blood was pumping out in spurts. Sergeant Talbert got to him and put a tourniquet on his arm. Only then did Lipton feel the pain in his crotch. He reached down for a feel, and his left hand came away bloody. Talbert, I may be hit bad," he said. Talbert slid his pants leg with the knife, took a look, and said, "You're okay." What a relief that was, Lipton remembered. The two shell fragments had gone into the top of his leg and missed everything important. Talbert threw Lipton over his shoulder and carried him to the aid station. The medics gave Lipton a shot of morphine and bandaged him up. So, you see, definitely goes according to what really happened. So I like the way that they do that. You know, they show us something that really happened, and the real concern that the real Lipton had at that very moment.
I have no problem sympathizing with Lipton's concerns.
Yes, exactly.
I'd be right there with him.
That's right. And Talbert just grabs him and lifts him up. And then we see a whole bunch of guys running through a corridor, the entrance to some building. And, we that they're all making their way through the town slightly. Welsh says, "Get Tipper up here with the bazooka." And they send Tipper across the street to the pharmacy. And you see that he's got the bazooka on his back. And He moves into the building and starts looking around, trying to figure things out. And he slowly moves all the way towards the back of the building and opens up the back door. And he gets startled by laundry.
As I do every week, I'm startled by laundry. Like this again?
Exactly. Well, let's put it this way. I hope you're never in a position where you're as scared of the laundry because you think the laundry might shoot back at you.
Yeah, I'm just scared that I have to do it. That's all that scares me about
Okay.
laundry.
I understood. That's completely understandable. And then he sees an outhouse and decides that it's possible that someone is hiding out in the outhouse and puts a bullet right through the outhouse stall and doesn't hear anything coming from that. So he turns around and you hear him say, "Hello, anybody there?" And then he turns around and starts walking back out through this building.
What does he expect the Germans to say? What does he expect the Germans to say? Yeah, we are here. Do not shoot us, Americans.
Exactly. No, well, maybe they'll say, "Don't shoot me, I surrender." I don't know. It could be also.
Yeah, we are very French. Do not shoot us.
That's possible also. We saw that yesterday. You never know who's
That
hiding
is
out.
true.
You never know who's
The,
hiding out in
they
the
didn't.
outhouse. And at this point, as he's walking back, there's a huge explosion. That again, the pyrotechnics here are just amazing, and they show how much the building just gets blown to smithereens. And then we see Tipper start walking through the building, a little staggering as he's walking out. They do a great job of making us feel and understand what he's going through because we hear Liebgott's muffled voice calling out to him, going, "Tipper, Tip, Tipper." He goes, "Answer me, Tip." And we see the look on Liebgott's face before we see Tipper. And Liebgott is completely shocked with the way that he looks. And you see that the guy next to him is even more scared about about the way that Tipper looks here. And then Tipper looks, he sees the looks on their faces. And he goes, "Joe." And he goes, "Looking good, Tip." He goes, "Is that you?" He goes, "Looking real good. Come here, buddy. You got to sit down. Come here. Come on. Easy, easy. There you go. There you go." And Liebgott comes over and gives him a huge hug. And I mean, first of all, this is an amazing shot, how they show this. The whole, again, this goes back to the camaraderie of Easy. Here you have one of your close friends, and you see that he's been majorly injured, and then Tip falls down onto the ground, and we've got looks down, and we see the damage that he's taken. We see that there's a wound on his face, and which possibly he might have lost an eye. There's blood dripping out of his face, but we also see that his legs, huge holes in them, and his foot has a huge hole in it also, which means that he probably stepped on a landmine or something like that. That's what I would guess. They don't show us specifically what he did, but we get to see this whole thing. And so once again, I'm going to go back to the book because the book explains this particular scene also, which is great the way that they explain it. Tipper and Liebgott cleared out a house. As Tipper was passing out the front door, a locomotive hit me, driving me far back inside the house. I heard no noise, felt no pain, and was somehow unsteadily standing and in possession of my M1. The German rear guard was bringing its pre-precision mortars into play. Liebgott grabbed Tipper and helped him to a sitting position, calling for a medic and trying to reassure Tipper that he would be okay. Welsh came up and got some morphine into Tipper, who was insisting that he could walk. That was nonsense. Both his legs were broken and he had a serious head wound. Welsh and Liebgott half dragged him into the street, where I remember lying at the base of the wall with explosions in the street and shrapnel zinging around the wall against the wall above my head. Welsh got Tipper back to the aid station, being set up in the barn about 20 meters to the rear. Now, Tipper survived, which I think is amazing that
Wow, that is amazing.
the way of what we see here. It doesn't look, and I gotta say, before I look this up, I always believed that this guy lost his legs and is on his he's on his last breath, but he made it out. He actually even became a teacher. He taught in a high school in Denver for 30 years.
Wow, good for him. Oh, that's great. Well, I'm really glad to hear that because I love this scene. I find the brotherly care that Leap God gives to Tip here to be really touching, that Leap God takes the time in the midst of this battle to provide some human comfort. And even if it didn't exactly happen this way in real life, just in this scene, that you have these two scenes back to back of some real some real brotherly affection. Like, don't worry, everything's right where it's supposed to be. So, there's some good support from your bro. And then here, after this terrible thing has happened to Tip, for Leapgap just to take the time, say, hey, you're looking good, but why don't you sit down, because he wants him to get off of his broken legs. It's clear he's walking around on him so he doesn't feel any pain. And just the moment he takes to just to hold him and to be present to him before getting him off to the aid station. I mean, yeah, as we've said before, the men aren't saints, but still, these moments of human connection they're very powerful. They're very moving. And it's even better that then Tipper has a story that goes on beyond
Just
this,
wait.
and such a long one too. That's
I'm
wonderful.
about to tell you something even more amazing that happens to him after in his real life. So he taught for 30 years, and then after retirement, he decided to go on a vacation to visit one of his former students in Costa Rica, and he fell in love with a 34-year-old woman, and courted for over a year, and they wanted to get married, and everyone was opposed to it. One of the few people who was for the fact that they should get married was Dick Winters, and because he was 61 at the time. Tipper was 61.
Oh, wow.
He was 61-year-old marrying a 34, and he said, it was the idea of her ever having a family, by marrying a 61-year-old man was slim to none. But just 10 months after they got married, they had a daughter, and their daughter ended up going to medical school and becoming a doctor in the 1980s. A few years later, he went and they bought a new house. And he said people kept saying to him that it's very strange that a 70-year-old man would be buying a new house. And he said that the reason he did it is his family motto has always been, it's never too late. Which to me is just
Wow.
amazing, thinking about the fact that, here you have a guy who was injured like this. And, obviously, we're not going to see Tipper again in the show because he's being tended to before being shipped back to
Yeah.
America, but just knowing that what happened to him later in life is just unbelievable. It's great.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
I want a movie about that guy's story. I want his whole life story told as a movie because that's incredible. You can't make that stuff up.
That's correct. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about numerous times is the fact that there are so many stories about the men from Easy Company that a 10-hour miniseries is so short to tell the story of all these men. It's something that would have that should have lasted. They could have done at least three or four other miniseries about it. There's at least, if not more.
Oh, easily. Yeah.
And like you said, they could have just made a movie just about Tipper's life, with this whole thing. So that's just amazing to think about from that perspective. So I just love the epilogue, I guess you can say, of what happened to him. We're getting to Father David's moment. We're just about there.
Yes.
We're just
Yes.
about there. The shot changes, and we see one of the men shooting out. Trying to shoot at one of the Germans, and we see what looks like a dead guy next to him, and then in the background you see another guy that's leaning over another soldier, and it's a little interesting because you're not really sure who it is. Very interesting, the way that they just show this little scene, and then you have a whole bunch of guys run across the street, and then we get a closer shot, and we see that it's actually a chaplain. That's leaning over this man there. Now, I'm assuming you know the answer to this, but do you know who that chaplain is?
That is Father John Maloney, regimental chaplain for the 506th Airborne Division.
Exactly. And what is he doing?
What is he doing? He is being an absolute hero. Oh, yes, I love this scene. So this was one of our favorite scenes when I was in seminary getting ready for the priesthood, because this is a model of heroism of a Catholic priest that was so inspiring to us. So a Catholic priest serving as a chaplain for the army is in the same position as a medic. He is not carrying a weapon and is responsible for the spiritual care of the men. And in the middle of this battle, he is going through the streets, finding the American soldiers who are still alive, and he is performing last rites for them. And the Catholic understanding is that in the moment of death, as a soul is about to leave the body, that is a privileged moment and a moment in which grace is necessary in order to prepare that soul for death and to prepare it for what we as Catholics believe to be the resurrection of the body, which comes at the end of all things. And so it is not just saying goodbye to the soul, but preparing the person for death to be in union with God at the moment of death, so that that union will continue to the end of time, to the hoped for resurrection from the of the dead. The sacrament that Father Maloney would be celebrating in this moment is called the Sacrament of Extreme Unction. That was the name it was used in 1944. It's called extreme, not because Father Maloney's riding a skateboard, but because he is performing it for those who are in extremis, those who are at the point of death. And unction refers to the anointing with oil, that a competition going on here. Father isn't using oils, and it could be in this battlefield situation he's not performing the full sacrament because there are a lot of people to minister to. There are other prayers that a Catholic priest in this situation would say that would assure the person of the closeness of God, the mercy of God, and would pray for the forgiveness of sins of the person who is dying. Because in the Catholic worldview, if someone is at the point of death, we want to ask for as much mercy as possible in that moment to prepare that soul for the life to come. One of the things that I love about this scene, not only is Father Maloney being such a hero to stand in the middle of this absolutely wrecked street, bullets are flying everywhere, but he is laser focused on his mission. I love the detail in this scene where he is checking for signs of life for those that he is celebrating the sacrament for. Because in the Catholic understanding, sacraments are not magic. They're not magic spells that we say over people, and because we say the spell, something happens. Sacraments are an expression of a relationship, and they are always sacraments for the living. And there is unfortunately no sacrament for someone who is already dead. All we can do living in this life is pray for the soul of that person and trust that God will care for them. So for Father Maloney, he's celebrating these sacraments, giving his blessings to those who are alive, to those who have, some way of perhaps of hearing him say these words and to have this moment of relationship with God mediated through these sacraments. So that's why we see him ministering to that first soldier that's on the ground. He goes over to the soldier who's been shot, checks for the pulse, doesn't find any, then moves on to the next soldier and prays with that one, because these sacraments are rituals. They're meant to be participated in, even in the midst of a battle as bullets are flying all over the place. I also love that so much is happening. Father hasn't had time to put his stole on. He's holding in his hands a prayer book and a rosary, and he has the stole. The stole is a Catholic liturgical garment that symbolizes the authority of a priest. Father Maloney doesn't even have it on in this scene. There's been so much he's been called upon to do. He hasn't taken the time to put it around act like you would normally do in this situation. All he can do is hold on to it as he is anointing and praying over each of these men. The other thing I love about Father Maloney, he is going with such confidence and fearlessness from one body to the next, from one person to the next. And he's doing that with the kind of clear-sighted sense of duty that we would expect from any of the soldiers who are fighting. And he's showing a similar courage, not in the direct confrontation with evil, but showing courage in providing that prayer, providing that sense of God's presence and mercy in the midst of evil. And the witness, the priestly courage that is shown in this scene has stuck with me for over 15 years from the first time that I saw this miniseries. This one little scene has been almost like an icon of priestly courage that I continue to aspire to live up to. Because
well, I hope you're never in that situation where you know you're under fire, having to give last.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really hope so too. And God knows what He's doing. God called Father John Maloney to serve in that kind of chaplaincy, and not me. I mean, there are priests who currently serve as chaplains to our armed forces and are willing to go into harm's way with them in order to be that minister of God's presence in the midst of a very difficult situation.
Right. Okay. So my question is this. Is performing last rites more important than keeping yourself safe?
The vocational understanding of the Catholic priesthood is one of self-gift, that in taking on the ministerial responsibility of the priesthood, I have put myself at the disposal of the will of God. And so for someone like Father Maloney, he would see his priestly responsibilities as oriented first toward the spiritual and pastoral care of others before his own safety. You know, he is the only priest who is there. There's no one else who is going to do this for these men than him. And the willingness to lay down one's life for that kind of spiritual care is heroic. Let's be clear. It's heroic.
Yeah, I completely agree.
If there was another priest who was there who wasn't doing what Father Maloney was doing and was waiting in a place of relative safety and ministering, you know, say to the men who are being brought back to the aid station or into the field hospital, that priest would not be blamed. It is not as though what Father Maloney is doing something that the church would expect every priest to do. But what Father Maloney is doing is admirable, and it is heroic, and it is above and beyond the call. So just as we have seen various soldiers throughout the series put themselves in harm's way for the sake of their brothers, you know, whether it was earlier in this episode 3 where you're running with a grenade in order to take out the machine gun nest, you know, that's heroic. It's also, you know, no one would blame you if you didn't do that.
Right.
This is another form of heroism, of going above and beyond for the sake of others. And what he is doing in the Catholic understanding merits that. It is important enough. You know, this is a moment of prayer and sacramental celebration that manifests the promise God has made us to be with us, even in the face of death. And the priest understands himself to be a minister of God's presence, to be the one called to make known God's will for mercy and healing and eternal life. And to do so, especially in the midst of a pitched battle like this, makes that message of God's presence shine out all the more brightly.
Yeah, for sure. There's no question about that. All right, so now I have some questions to see how much you know about chaplaincy in the Army during World War II. So do you have any idea?
Oh boy.
How many U.S. Army chaplains were there during World War II?
That is a good question. I'm going to completely guess. I'm going to guess there were, 750.
There were 9,117 U.S. Army chaplains that served during World War II. Plus another few hundred Navy chaplains.
Ooh, so I was close.
If you multiply by hundreds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. See,
There
yeah,
were
I was only off by order of magnitude. That's all.
exactly right. There were more than 12,000 chaplains who served in
Wow.
all the armed services of the U.S. during World War II. Okay, so how many of these 12,000 chaplains were killed in action?
Oh, out of the 12,000, how many were killed? I'm gonna say 5,000.
24 were killed. 24 chaplains.
24.
24 killed
Well, so again, I
chaplains.
was close.
Yes, 24 chaplains were killed in action. 66 were wounded in action. And 8 of them were captured by the enemy and later released. Okay.
Wow.
All right. How many were killed on D-Day itself?
Okay, well, if okay, so I can do this math. If 24 died in World War II, D-Day, that was, I mean, Normandy landing was pretty tough. I'm going to guess half of them died on D-Day. So I'm going to guess 12 died on D-Day.
One, only one.
So I was close. This is the closest I've been.
Okay, that's true.
Now I'm only off by 11 instead of several orders of magnitude.
The chaplain of the 82nd Airborne Division, Father Ignatius Mertonowski, is the only chaplain casualty of D-Day itself. I don't know exactly what happened to him, which now I'm actually curious. Was he, did his chute not open, or was he on one of the planes, or something like that? That that actually makes me very curious to try to think about that. He was 32 years old, and he was in the fifth year of calling, I guess you can say, and. So he enlisted in the army in 1942, and then he was part of the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne. He parachuted behind German lines near Gouteville, France, and his company's mission was to secure bridges in order to help the Allied invasion of Normandy faster and easier. It doesn't say, it just says by nighttime he was dead. It doesn't say what happened to him. Whether I again, my assumption is based on what this says is he was not on one of the planes. He successfully parachuted, and was killed in action, at some point during the fighting during that day.
Interesting.
What different religions were part of the U.S. Army chaplaincy during World War II?
Well, you'd have the Roman Catholics, you'd have a variety of Protestants. I doubt you had many non-Abrahamic chaplains. I don't think there'd be Buddhist or Hindu chaplains in large numbers in the 1940s. Same thing with Muslim chaplains, though maybe. And I expect there were some, maybe some Jewish chaplains. But I think there would be primarily representation from the Christian denominations.
Correct. Okay, so there were about 5,500 Protestant chaplains, a little more than 2,000 Catholic chaplains, and 243 Jewish chaplains that served during World War II. So, yeah, those were the that's the breakdown from then.
Which tracks with the demographics of the 1940s.
Yes. There's also a famous story from February 3rd, 1943, where there were four chaplains who all died on the same day together. They
Oh,
were
my.
on a ship that was torpedoed, the SS Dorchester, and each of the four was from a different denomination. One was a Methodist, one was Reformed Church, one was Catholic, and one was Jewish.
Wow.
The it's interesting because I mean we've been reading from the book and the book has a sentence about Father John Maloney here also, and it says Malarkey recalled that during the tremendous period of fire I could hear someone reciting a Hail Mary. I glanced up and saw Father John Maloney holding his rosary and walking down the center of the road to administer last rites to the dying at the road juncture. Maloney was eventually awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for the work that he did. So yeah, see the
Wow, well deserved.
Yes,
well deserved.
Yes, especially by the way that they show it to us here, what happens. We see that Malarkey and Muck are watching Father Maloney, and Muck goes, "Hey, Malark, you see what I'm seeing?" And and then Malarkey just turns and walks away and goes, "Crazy fools, the Irish." And Muck goes, "You should know." So, yeah, but
yes, we are.
Yeah, I just love the fact that they have this 20-second scene just to show us the heroism of John Maloney at this point. You know, and we see all these explosions going on around him and stuff like that. And then the men move along to try to continue taking the street. And they see the Germans running with rocket-propelled grenade. I don't even know what you want to call it. their transport, I guess you could say. And and then we see two guys enter a building, and they, you know, open up the window and start. One of them, Smokey, and he goes, "Smokey, the window, let's go!" And they just start shooting at the Germans that are retreating. You know, going back to what we were talking about yesterday about the fact that in the midst of these battles, these guys were just, you know, going forward. They weren't thinking about. They just have to. You have to stop the enemy. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, and from a brutal tactical perspective, you know, every dead enemy is one less enemy that can regroup and come back on your position.
Correct.
And I understand the strategic considerations here, but this was hard to watch. It's hard to watch men who are running away get shot in the back.
Correct. But again, they, you know, they, you know, you don't want the enemy to come back. And if you leave them alive,
right,
it's a problem. You know, I can understand that fact. And then the scene changes, and we just see Winters walking on the street itself. Like, everything is calm now. You know, they basically abruptly end this, you know, this whole battle, the way that they do that with the shooting of the Germans that are retreating. And you know, Winters is in a calm area, just walking around. And we hear a horse galloping, and a friend of the show, Freddie Joe Farnsworth, shows up. He's sitting on the horse. Just to remind anyone who doesn't remember, so I interviewed Freddie Joe. He's one of the guys who trained the men. He was part of Dale Dye's staff. And he gets this cameo of they needed someone who knew how to ride a horse. And so he's here.
And he does. I what a beautiful looking animal. I got to say, that's an impressive looking horse.
Yes. Yes. And he goes, "Ho, morning, sir." And Winters goes, "What's your name, trooper?" And he goes, "Sergeant Farnsworth from Able Company 501. So it's great that he gets to use his own name also. He goes, "I'm supposed to tell you that we got it clear from here. All the way to the north of them Krauts, sir." He goes, "Well, tell your CO 506 arrived in force and secured all positions south of you." "Yes, sir, I'll tell him. Come on, bad boy, let's go." And he, you know, takes the horse and they gallops away. So again, a great cameo. Nicely done, Freddie Joe.
Good work as always.
Exactly. He probably loved doing that scene also. You know, just standing there waving around with the, you know, with the pistol, you know, as he's talking to Winters. You know, and he just takes off, and then Nixon walks into the street. And then we see behind him, Strayer's there, and Strayer goes, "Lieutenant Winters." He goes, "Yes, sir." He goes, "Is it safe to cross now?" He goes, "What's that, sir? Is it safe to cross? We want to move the wounded." Great excuse. But it's just funny because, you know, at this point, we get a great look between Winters and Nixon, basically saying to themselves, how did this guy become a major?
They've had a whole conversation with just that look between the two of them.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yes. You know, showing how fearful Strayer is at this point, you know, but he has the excuse of that. We need to move the wounded. So that works. And then he cautiously walks out into the street and he goes, "Come on, let's get him out of here." And at this point, you know, Winters is still walking around this area, And then we see a Ricochet come in and hit him on the foot, and we see him he's not happy. That this is
No, understandably so. And especially after the irony of saying, oh, yeah, of course it's safe to cross. And
that's right.
now he's the one limping around with a piece of metal in his leg.
Correct.
Poor Winters.
Yes, he's not too happy about this whole thing. We see him hop around a little bit, looking at his leg, saying, "How did that happen to me?" And then the shot changes.
He makes the same noises and face I would make in this same situation.
I think most
I
people
would
would
be.
make that same.
When he's mad at himself too, and I love the last shot where he just looks disappointed. He's mad. He's like, "Oh, I'm such an idiot. Oh man."
That's right. And then the shot changes, and he's in the aid station, and we have Doc Rowe taking care of him. We see that he pulls out the piece of shrapnel and goes, "There she is." He goes, "You're lucky it was a ricochet. You just caught a piece of it."
No kidding.
And he goes,
Yeah, no kidding. If it had been a full bullet,
"That's
he wouldn't.
right." And he goes, "Oh, stupid." And he goes, "What? Nothing." And then,
Which is an interesting little moment. He can't afford to be, he doesn't feel like he can be more vulnerable than he is already because he feels the weight of his leadership position.
that's
And
right.
he doesn't want his self-recrimination to be too audible. It's bad enough that he's gotten shot in the leg. He doesn't want to undermine his authority by having the men hear him call himself stupid.
Exactly. And then Doc Rowe says, "Now you're gonna be able to stay off it." And he goes, "Doesn't look that way." "You gotta try."
This is war, son. Come on, get serious.
Now, what I love is, I had a conversation with Bruce McKenna, who is one of the writers of the show, and he said that because he was doing an episode on Doc Rowe, that he spoke to the writer of this episode and said, "All right, we have a medic there. Can you make that medic Doc Rowe, so that when he shows up later, nobody will just say, 'Oh, who's that guy?'" We get a little bit of an introduction to Doc Rowe at this point. And then Buck shows up and says, "Well, what have we got planned, Chief?" He says, "Well, we expect a counterattack. Counterattack is as important to them as it is to us." He goes, "Any idea when? We're not waiting around to find out. Battalion wants us to head east towards high ground, set up a defensive position. With all the flooded fields, it's the only direction they could approach from." "Yeah." And he goes, "You gonna be all right?" He goes, "Yep. Yeah, I'm good." And then he looks over at Doc Rowe and goes, "What's wrong with Blythe?" He sees Blythe just standing on the side there, and he goes, "Well, nothing. He just can't see." He goes, "He can't see?" So he says, there's a little bit of doubt in his voice, but people will have to come back tomorrow to find out what they actually think is going on with Blythe. So is there anything else you wanted to mention about these 5 minutes?
I got more than my fair share in. I'm so happy we're able to talk about Father Maloney. Thank you so much for this opportunity to revisit one of my priest cinema heroes.
I'm so happy to have been able to help you with that. So today's segment is Oh Brother, where my guests will give their top five movie brothers. So, Father David, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Well, number five comes from a movie that comes very highly recommended. It is a movie that's on a very elite list of movies, and that is a Pope's list of favorite movies. Pope Leo XIV recently named some of his favorite movies, and one of them is Ordinary People, a 1980 film directed by Robert Redford. And it focuses on Conrad, played by Timothy Hutton, who is dealing with the loss of his brother, Buck. So the brotherhood in this movie is wrestling with that absence of the brother figure and how Conrad wrestles with life now that his brother is gone. I don't want to say too much more about the movie, but I highly recommend it as a viewing for our listeners, because it's a really well-acted piece. Donald Sutherland and Mary Tyler Moore play the parents of Conrad and Buck, and as you'd expect, they do a phenomenal job. So Ordinary People is number five for my movie brother.
That's a very, very unique choice. I like where you went with that. Because I mean, I can honestly say you were the first person to choose that on this list. But you know, now that I think about it, it makes so much sense. Like when you originally said ordinary people, my first thought was, wait a second. But then, you know, as you started explaining and I started recalling what happened in the movie, obviously that's a very unique bond of brothers, I guess you can say.
Well, thank you. Well, then number four, I'm not totally just ripping off Pope Leo's list, but it does happen to be another movie on his list, but it's also one of my favorite movies. Number four is It's a Wonderful Life. The relationship between George and Harry Bailey is a really important thread that runs through that film. The brother Harry as this sterling example, as who seems to be the favorite, the kid who can do no wrong, who has everything going right for him, who gets the girl, has the heroic career in the army, who is able to achieve all of the dreams that George, frustrated at home, doesn't seem to be able to get. Again, reveals that really interesting tension between brothers, and of course, in the Pottersville section of the movie, George learns what an impact he's had on Harry's life. And I think Harry Bailey has one of the best lines in the movie at the very end: "To my brother George, the richest man in town," which, as a brother, boy, what it means to have your brother say something like that about you. It is such an affirmation. So that's part of the magic and joy of that movie is the brother dynamic between George and Harry.
Great, another great choice.
Then number three is A River Runs Through It, based on Norman MacLean's autobiography, his experience growing up in Missoula, Montana, and his relationship to his Presbyterian minister father, but also to his brother Paul. And this is a great study in contrast. It's like if George and Harry never left Bedford Falls, what would happen if they both stayed in their little town? And what would be the dynamic between them? How would they interact with their father? How would it all play out? And of course, Craig Sheffer and Brad Pitt both do phenomenal jobs in acting in A River Runs Through It. It also is a movie not only about brothers, but the things that men bond over. And so that fly fishing aspect of the movie, you know, Paul's development of the craft and the way that earns the father's respect. And so Norman is working through rather study and writing because he doesn't quite connect with his father in the fly fishing kind of way. Again, so it reveals an important dynamic of brothers in terms of relationship with the father and how do you respond to the man your father is? How do you try to make yourself like him? How do you try to yourself set yourself up in opposition to him? And then how that's revealed in your relationship with your siblings and your brothers as well.
Wow. Okay. Excellent.
Number two, The Godfather Part Two. Poor Fredo. He's not stupid. He's smart, but nobody believes it. Least of all, Michael. Part of the tragedy of The Godfather Part Two is the breakdown in that brotherhood relationship. Michael's already been desensitized by violence, by loss in the family, the loss of his father, the loss of Sonny. And then for him to be so desensitized that he no longer sees Fredo as a brother, as someone who is worthy of unconditional love, as someone like, okay, yep, yeah, he might be annoying, he might be an idiot, he might get some things wrong, but you know, he's family. So what are you going to do? For Michael to be so numbed by the life he has steeped himself in order to see Fredo no longer as a brother, but as an obstacle, as something to eliminate in order to keep the organization going, to make sure the family business is secure, that you even have to sacrifice family to do so. Well, it's just a gut punch and just part of that fall from grace that is the entire narrative arc of Michael's story in The Godfather. Just to see that loss of the brotherhood there and to go from the death of a brother, like in Sonny, from being a tragedy that provokes family unity, to then the death of a brother being a necessary step for the preservation of the family. Oof. Just very chilling.
All right, excellent.
So then, number one, now, you know, some might like to say that there's bias involved in this choice. Some people might say that this is an unserious choice for the number one, but if we're going to talk about the best movie brothers, where that relationship is central to the movie, and just in terms of time on screen together, I mean, number one has to be the Blues Brothers. Now, that entire movie is about, it sets up that brotherhood dynamic right from the very first scene. Because if brotherhood is not picking your brother up from jail and then having that brother make fun of your new car on the drive back from jail, I don't know what brotherhood is then. That relationship between Jake and Elroy is established early on, played for laughs, but then it's just a constant bedrock for everything else that happens. They are in it together through thick and thin, through getting the band back together, through dealing with Illinois Nazis, to taking the collection to City Hall to save the orphanage. They deal with their surrogate mother figure in the Penguin. They deal with their a surrogate father figure. They wrestle with each other. They deal with Jake's stuff with his fiance, who he left at the altar. So they go through everything together as brothers. And there are no big heart-to-hearts, no big moving scenes. You're not going to have Donald Sutherland and Timothy Hutton having a tearful scene at the end of a movie like in the Blues Brothers. But there's in some ways, the Blues Brothers represent kind of the idealized form of brotherhood, where he's your brother, he's going to be there through everything. You're not going to agree on everything, but he's going to be there no matter what. Plus, since we were talking about band of brothers in these episodes, brothers that are in a band, I mean, that already adds about 100 points on movie brothers aspects to things. So that's why I put Blues Brothers as number one movie brothers.
Okay, you're not the first person, and you will definitely not be the last person to have it there. So you're fine. You're fine. Up until now, there are four people that have it in their top spot.
Those are very smart people.
Yes,
They have excellent taste.
I would agree. I would agree. All right, now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie. So let's
All
spin the
right.
wheel one more time and see what it gives us. So around and around and around the wheel goes.
It's all or nothing for me today, listeners. Got an uneven record. I want to end on a high note.
Okay, here's something that it's actually very fitting for you to get this movie. No
Oh
question
boy.
about
Okay.
that.
Okay.
Okay, this is a movie that came out in 1976, and it is about a German plot to kidnap Winston Churchill.
Kidnapping Winston Churchill.
And the reason it's befitting to you is just the other day we talked about one of the actors who is one of your favorite actors from The Great Escape, who is also in this movie.
Oh, this is a Donald Pleasance movie. Oh my
This
gosh. Oh,
is a Donald Pleasance movie, yes.
I have to get this.
And he plays Himmler, plays Heinrich Himmler.
What great casting. Oh, what great casting. This is wait. Oh no, wait, hold on. Oh wait, because I'm getting it. It's not no, because Valkyrie's the Tom Hanks one where you try to blow up Hitler.
And
This
that
is
was
the
in
one.
2000, that was not 1976.
Right. So, but
That's 2008.
it's something. It's something with the eagle,
Yeah,
right?
correct. You are on the right track. Very good.
The eagle has landed.
Perfect. Nicely done.
Yes. Yes.
Nicely done. All right. So would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
They can find me relieved in the Donald Pleasance fan club, knowing that I was able to name that last movie correctly. But otherwise, you can find me at my website, fatherdavidmowry.com. I post regular recordings of my preaching there and have links to the Great Escape Minute, which I did with Rob, and links to various other Movies by Minutes projects that I've done over the years. So please look me up at fatherdavidmowry.com.
Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Father David, thank you very much for joining me the last few days. It's been It's been great having you on once again.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob. It was a delight to, well, I wouldn't say it was a delight to be in Keratin, but it was a delight to talk about it.
It was a delight to watch what goes on in character. How's that?
Yes, there. Yeah, good. Yeah.
There you go. And discuss it. All right. So I'll be back tomorrow with another guest, but until then, Kurahi!
Kurahi!